McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. Today's guest, Michael Lind, has written an economic history of the United States in his new book, Land of Promise. Lind lays out a pattern in which the U.S. has reinvented itself economically and politically a number of times, based usually on the emergence of new technologies, from wind and water to steam to electricity and internal combustion, and finally, the computer. Each new dominant technology overwhelms the existing political and regulatory system, and American government lags a generation or two behind this technology-induced economic change. And he says it takes a crisis or a war or both to overthrow the old regime and usher in the new. When the U.S. economy has flourished, Lind argues, government and business, labor, and universities have worked together as partners in a project of economic nation building. Today, as the United States struggles to emerge from the Great Recession, Land of Promise says that Americans, since the earliest days of the Republic, have repeatedly reinvented the American economy and have the power to do so again. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Michael Lind is a co-founder of the New America Foundation, where he is policy director of the Economic Growth Program. He's taught at Harvard and Johns Hopkins. He writes for the Financial Times, the New York Times, and has a weekly column at Salon. He's written several books, including Up from Conservatism, Why the Right is Wrong for America, The Next American Nation, Vietnam, The Necessary War, and his latest, Land of Promise, an Economic History of the United States, as well as several volumes of fiction and poetry and even a children's book. Welcome again, Michael Lind, to Free Forum.
Thanks.
As you know, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So could you briefly talk about your path to the work you're doing today? Not so much why you wrote this book, we'll get into that, but more sort of the bigger path of your life. To flesh out that brief bio from your point of view.
Right,
and
right.
Feel free to cite mentors, turning points, moments of decision.
Well, I come out of the southwestern Texas wing of the New Deal tradition. Of the Rooseveltian, New Deal, Great Society, LBJ tradition. I grew up in Austin, Texas, fifth-generation native. And like many in my generation, when the New Deal coalition broke apart, basically when I was in high school, you had the kind of the emergence of this new party system with Reagan Republicans on the one hand and the progressives sort of went in a different direction, at least on some issues, than they had in the period between the 1930s and the 1960s. And so like a lot of stranded New Dealers, I found myself a neoconservative back when that meant paleoliberal, that is Kennedy-Johnson Democrat. And the chief thing that distinguished us others in the Democratic Party, it was foreign policy. We were hawkish on the Soviet Union until the end of the Cold War, at which point one of my mentors, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, mm-hmm. basically abandoned what were then called the neocons who took on a quite different coloration after the end of the Cold War. We supported a strong social insurance system, universal programs, but also were opposed to race-based affirmative action for practical reasons. We thought it would divide the white working class from people of color and undermine the liberal coalition, which arguably it has done to some degree. I was sort of a rising star among these neoconservatives. I was a protege of William F. Buckley Jr., who had pretty far to the center by the end of the Reagan years. I worked at the National Interest for our publisher, Irving Kristol, who's sometimes described as the godfather of the neoconservatives.
Right,
But I thought we were carrying on the old FDR, LBJ, Harry Truman, Hubert Humphrey tradition when, in fact, by the early 1990s, the neocons had thrown themselves in with the Republican Party and were teaming up with the religious right, the National Rifle Association, instead of welcoming the end of the Cold War as a way to go back to being an ordinary country, in a world governed by international institutions, which is what Daniel Patrick Moynihan and also Jean Kirkpatrick may surprise some of your listeners. But she was one of the ones who wanted a less hawkish foreign policy after the 1989 and the fall of the Berlin Wall. So the second wave neocons threw in their lot with the radical right.
Right.
And I had a rather nasty public breaking with them, which included an expose in the New York Review of Books in 1995 of the Reverend Pat Robertson's theories explaining world history in terms of the machinations of Freemasons, Jewish bankers, Satan, various other shady characters.
Can't get much shadier than that.
Yeah. So to this day, I'm sort of considered an apostate from the right. Although, as I say, as a neocon, I was never really a conservative. I was a paleo-liberal. And right now, I would describe myself as a progressive in the Rooseveltian tradition, which I as I explained in the book, there are other traditions on the left, obviously.
Right, right.
But that's one strain.
Okay. That's good. I think that sets things up well, and that's where that Up From Conservatism book
right.
comes about, is following your New York Review of Books article was your first book, right?
No, the first book was called The Next American Nation,
oh, right.
which was a study of changing conceptions of racial identity in American history. But Up From Conservatism, it was my critique of the direction that the right was taking. And I have to say that now in 2012, really about 15 years after all of this, a little longer, one of my allies after another at the time on the right followed my lead and broke with them. Frank Fukuyama, Francis Fukuyama, Andrew Sullivan, most recently David Frum, George W. Bush's speechwriter. He and I were intellectual rivals throughout the Bush years. We're now friends. He was kicked out of the American Enterprise Institute. They locked him out of his office very unceremoniously, told him to get out when he had made a few minor criticisms of the Republican Party. So I think in retrospect, I started an exodus of thinkers from the center right to the center left, or at least the center.
And one thing that you point out is that thing where you said before they'd thrown in completely with the religious right and so on, that race-based affirmative action and so on might split the working class, the white working class, from the African American working class or minority working class. That certainly. If it didn't make what you said might happen, it has certainly been seized upon and used by the right to act to accelerate that process.
Oh yeah, definitely. And you see the same thing with immigration policy, where it was the position of Robert Bartley Jr., the late editor of the Wall Street Journal. He wanted to have a constitutional amendment saying we shall have open borders. And so they're actually – when your listeners really ought to know this. Up until the late 1990s, there was a very strong position on the center left that said you cannot have high minimum wages, a generous welfare state, very strong unions if you have weak labor markets and if you have a divided workforce so that employers can pit workers against each other on the basis of race and ethnicity and region and so on. So for pro-labor solidarity reasons – there was always a desire to limit immigration to the point that it did not depress wages at the bottom and also that you do not gratuitously add to the already very deep existing differences between the white working class and the African-American working class and Latinos and others. And for that reason, there was a strain of the Democratic Party associated with the liberal integrationists, including Bayard Rustin, the organizer of the March on Washington, as well as Martin Luther King Jr. Sometimes he sort of went back and forth. But King, his whole idea of a poor people's budget was that you would bring in the poor whites, particularly the poor whites of the South, who had been victims not of the racial caste system, but they were victims of the Southern economic system, even if they were racist themselves. Right, it's not a matter of attitude. It's a matter of your position in the structure
right.
of society, and particularly if in my native South, the elite for centuries has governed by dividing and ruling.
Of course.
So anything that exacerbates this sense of different identities tends to weaken the cause of ordinary people and of organized labor. We lost that argument by the end of the 1990s. You could no longer criticize high levels of unskilled immigration. you can no longer criticize race-based policies as opposed to, say, class-based policies.
Right.
And the reason for that was that by that time, Democratic strategists had written off the white working class,
and,
as they are doing again in this election.
And
basically,
had seen that the demographics of Latino population increase was working in their favor.
Well, yes and no. That's kind of a myth. The reason the Democrats have done fairly well in the congressional election 2008 and then in the Obama's election, it's an influx of upscale whites plus Latinos. So the Democrats mm-hmm. now have picked up a lot of the former so-called Rockefeller Republicans from the northeastern Midwestern states. Now, this is a dubious benefit from the point of view of us old-fashioned New Dealers. Because the Rockefeller Republicans, they bring their traditionally enlightened attitudes towards race.
On social issues.
Towards reproductive freedom. I mean, they've always been for contraception and availability back to the early 20th century. On environmentalism, they've always been the champions. But they tend to be fairly conservative on economics. And they think we're spending too much on Social Security and Medicare and that taxes are too high. You can see why some of us have sort of floated between the two coalitions.
Yeah.
Although, by contemporary standards, I'm center left, if not slightly radical in some ways.
It's crazy enough. So let's move up to this book. How did this book happen is a common question, but I have a feeling that this is for you, Michael, a major tome. This is more than just another book.
Yeah, this is something I've been thinking about for really a quarter of a century, you know, back to my earliest years in politics, because I was interested in what were the deeper roots of this New Deal tradition that I identified with. And you can trace it back from Franklin Roosevelt, the critical figure, to his cousin Theodore Roosevelt. There were some differences between TR and FDR, but the younger man sort of worshipped the older Roosevelt and followed in his footsteps. Literally one job after another, Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Vice President, Governor of New York, President. So FDR modeled himself on TR in many ways. And Theodore Roosevelt came out of the reform wing of the Lincoln Republicans from the Civil War. The Lincoln Republicans, when Abraham Lincoln, the subject of another one of my books, in what is kind of a series that includes my book, What Lincoln Believed, although this is a freestanding a narrative history of the economy. Abraham Lincoln, when he was asked what he believed, he always said something like this. He said, "I am an old-fashioned Henry Clay Whig, W-H-I-G. Well, people may not remember the Whig Party, but Henry Clay was the dominant figure of the Whig Party versus the Democrats under Andrew Jackson in the first half of the 19th century. And he championed, as I describe in Land of Promise, this ambitious nation-building, economy-building system of national banking, federal-financed infrastructure, federal support for manufacturing, which in turn goes all the way back as an agenda to Alexander Hamilton, the first Secretary of the Treasury in the first presidential administration, that of George Washington. So over the last decade and a half or so, I've been piecing this tradition out.
So in some sense, tracing your roots.
Yes, and I tell people that it's because I am a Southerner from the heart of Jefferson Jackson territory that I'm such an ardent admirer of the Hamiltonians, because they have always the Hamiltonians, the ones who want a strong nation state, federal protection for civil rights, federal investment in infrastructure, have always been seen as the enemies by the local oligarchy in the South, which wanted local control of its workforce and no external interference, and was perfectly content to have a fairly primitive, backward, agrarian economy, or in the case of Texas, Louisiana, oil-exporting commodity economy. And so if you look at – you know, a lot of people – what I find is people from the West and the Northeast and the Midwest, they have these favorable associations of Jeffersonianism. It's the little guy and entrepreneurialism and so on. But if you look at the part of the country that was the most deeply imbued with Jeffersonian principles is the Deep South. It's the most backward, screwed up part of the country, you know, to this day. There's some Texas legislators. I used to work in the Texas legislature in my youth who every year or so come up with a list of where the state of Texas, which is now the second biggest state in the union, is ranked on infant mortality, education, and things like that. And to some degree, as in the case of California, you do have a lot of unskilled and low-wage immigration. And it's sort of – you can't really blame the system for not immediately digesting all of these folks. But it's still pretty disastrous. If you look at the parts of the country where you have the highest per capita GDP, the best school systems and so on, they do come out of this older Hamiltonian, Whig, Lincoln Republican tradition. So in that sense, if you look at the Obama Democrats, their base now is in the Northeast and the Midwest and the West Coast, which was traditionally the heartland of this Hamiltonian tradition. And the Republicans, the parties have simply switched bases. The Republicans, which are the party of small government, states' rights, anti-statism, those were the traditional themes of the disciples of Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson. And appropriately enough, the Republicans are based where the Democrats were a century ago. Right. In the Deep South and in the plains and prairie states.
Yeah. You started this book a long time ago because, as you said, you were in your own self looking at where are my roots, where do I come from, where am I thinking at least. Putting it out at this moment, what is your hope?
Well, I argue in Land of Promise that the U.S. has had in effect three different republics under the same name of the United States of America and under the same formal constitution of 1788 that went into effect in 1789. In France, they're now on their fifth republic since the French Revolution in 1789. They're much more honest than
and they actually acknowledge them.
You know, so they've had five republics, two empires, a directory, a consulate. You know, so they're quite honest about this. There's an old joke about an American tourist who goes to a Parisian bookseller and he asks for a copy of the French Constitution. And the bookseller looks at him with great disdain and says, Monsieur, we do not sell periodical literature. But we pretend that we're still living under the system of 1787-88 that the founders came up with at Philadelphia. The Supreme Court in practice reinterprets things so that we have it just as much radical change as the French or these other people who go through multiple constitutions do.
And so, I would guess, I mean, just to comment on the moment, this particular Supreme Court, the majority in this particular Supreme Court seems to do radical things and claim more than ever.
Which is very interesting because in the 80s, originalism, original intent was the creed of the Federalist Society and of the conservative jurists. And they seemed quite as activist as any progressive jurists ever were. But so I build in this book on a schema that I came up with in my earlier book, The Next American Nation, that we've had three republics, one from the founding. It fell apart in the Civil War, and then we rebuilt the Second Republic under Lincoln and his successors during Reconstruction. That lasted up until the Depression fell apart under Hoover. Franklin Roosevelt is really the founder of the Third Republic, which in the 90s I thought at some point there's going to be some crisis that does this third version of the United States in. And I think in 2008 with the global financial crash, much of the establishment in the United States still thinks this is a really bad recession. At some point, we will go back to the status quo ante 2008. It's not going to happen. That world is gone forever. Even the term recovery, I think, is a mistake. We should be talking about reconstruction.
Well, we'd have to come up with a new term, renewal.
Renewal.
Yeah.
But it's a matter of building a new system from
rubble. That's right.
It's not putting Humpty Dumpty back together.
Now, I've often thought that one of the reasons that I agree with you, and let me tell people, I'm Terrence McNally speaking with Michael Lynn. We're talking about the ideas in his book, Land of Promise and Economic History of the U.S. And to learn more, you can go to newamerica.net and look for Michael Lind, L-I-N-D, that – part of that was that some of the jobs, but not just the jobs, some of the wealth that was apparently around in the 90s and the 2000s was not real, that it was based on –
it was illusory.
Right. It was based on credit, refinancing, you know, for eventually, you know, betting on your home and
right.
so on. And that when that bubble burst – There was no way that bubble was going to be reinflated, that balloon was ever coming back, and that harsh truth is something that people have not been willing to admit.
That's exactly right. In fact, if you go – the chapter in my book on this in Land of Promise is called The Bubble Economy from the 1980s all the way up until 2008. you had in the United States, consumers, their wages were too low to support their lifestyles, so they borrowed massively. This borrowing was enabled in part by governments running perpetual trade surpluses like China, which were also suppressing the wages of their own workers as a deliberate policy. Well, if you have a world in which both the developing countries and the developed countries are depressing the wages of their own workers, first world and third world, and consumption is being driven by borrowing, and the premise is that people are going to make enough money over the next 10, 15, 20 years to pay back these enormous sums, those sums are never going to be paid back. And if you look just at the United States alone, much of this housing wealth was a fiction. I mean, it was a fantasy to begin with. It could never possibly these properties could never be sold at that price.
Right.
A lot of the mortgages, for houses and cars, there was no way the people who took these out were going to make the wage income necessary to pay it back. So what happens when you get an asset bubble, that is a run up in the price of assets like houses and real estate.
And education.
Education, which people I think correctly are saying was part of the bubble economy. When that collapses, then you get this really nasty, bitter, divisive, zero-sum politics, because everyone knows that 10 or 15 or 20% of the economy has just vaporized or never was there in the first place. So the battle is to force other people to swallow the loss so that you don't. So the creditors want the debtors to swallow the loss. The debtors want the creditors to swallow the loss. Everybody wants the taxpayers to socialize the loss. And that's what's going on. It's going on within countries like the U.S. and it's going on among countries like
Europe.
Germany and its neighbors, China and its trading partners.
Mm. Yeah. And so what you're saying is that we've had these three republics. And the interesting thing that I mentioned briefly in the introduction is that the three republics correspond to three industrial revolutions, and that there's this lag between the industrial revolution and the regulatory and the whole conceptual framework of government catching up with the new technology, and that we are right now we're suffering the crisis, but we are not yet seeing, as you say, even the talk really of the emergence of the next republic.
Yeah, that's right. My thesis is that we've had three waves of industrial change. You can call them industrial revolutions. One based on the steam engine, the second industrial revolution based on automobiles, internal combustion engines and electricity, and the third on information technology. They correspond to the three political revolutions we've had here.
Right. And what's left out of that, in case someone was keeping count, was that the original prior to the first one, prior to the steam engine one, was the agrarian craftsman one.
Well, that's right. Yeah. The United States is
was
older
born
than
in
the
that.
Industrial Revolution.
That's right. It was born in that system.
Exactly. And so there's always been a lag in that sense, because even the far-sighted nationalists like Alexander Hamilton, their ambitious scheme involved canals.
Right.
So maybe you could go to New York in 3 days instead of a week, right? And an agrarian economy. They did picture machinery, but it would be powered by water mills.
Yeah.
Right. And so then all of that was just erased within a few decades by steam locomotives and
right.
steam ships.
And you open with this anecdote about Paterson, New Jersey, which was, just a perfect example of that economy.
Well, Hamilton was a visionary. He was – you'd have to look to some of the East Asian statesmen like Lee Kuan Yew of Singapore, to have that kind of vision nowadays. The U.S. was a kind of broken down agrarian collection of ex-colonies, and Hamilton and others wanted to turn it into the equivalent of Britain or France with government support. So he proposed creating an artificial industrial city. An industrial complex of what is now Paterson, New Jersey. It's kind of like these special economic zones they have in South China, same principle. It went bankrupt initially, but then as often happens, the initial failures fertilized the ground for success later. And so all the way until the 20th century, Paterson is home to one industry after another. But as I explained in Land of Promise, whenever we invent our republic, and whenever we modernize our political and legal institutions, it's usually to deal with a problem that is already 30, 40 years out
right.
of date. It's
That's
the last
that lag.
Revolution.
Yeah.
So at the very moment that we've solved the problems of 30 or 40 years ago that we've been ignoring for a generation, some new technology is bubbling up that is destined to overthrow what we're doing at this very moment in the next 20 or 30 years. I see that as an encouraging sign. It means that we will never run out of things to do and have established this perfect utopia.
It also means that we're not stuck with where we are. That as much as we may hold on to and persist in what doesn't work, eventually it doesn't work so much that it changes.
Yeah, and the thing about technological progress is this is happening not only in the United States, these waves of industrial change, but in the whole world, including messed up portions of the world like much of Latin America in the last couple of hundred years that is finally getting over some of their own backwardness. But the fact is, even if you have a really terrible political system, over time you get better dentistry, less infant mortality, if nothing else.
When I ask people what countries they think are doing things right nowadays, people often say Brazil.
Yeah, Brazil has had very good constructive leadership in recent years. Their weaknesses, they've been dependent on commodity exports, particularly to China. And so to some degree, as the Chinese export engine winds down because of the lack of American consumer demand that was feeding it and because the Chinese consumers have not been given the wages yet,
that's right,
you know, to compensate for the loss of the American consumer. But I think if you look at the 21st century in general, we pretend that we live in this decentralized global world in which borders don't matter and so on. The fact is large countries with diverse internal populations and resources like the United States, Brazil, even if you look at our major Western rivals, first world rivals, Japan and Germany are the two most populous nation states after the United States. Having a large home market gives enormous advantages to your companies in terms of the increasing returns of scale industries. Having diverse regions benefits countries like the United States and Brazil because at any given time, one part of the country might be having a recession, and that part of the country might be as big as an entire nation state in Europe or Asia. But because we have what the European Union lacks, that is a transfer union, a banking union, free flow of labor across state borders in the case of the United States. So if the West Coast is down, then the Midwest could be booming. Those Midwestern revenues flow into federal unemployment insurance, which then goes to California. And so it's still a great advantage being part of a continental union, which is why I'm glad my Confederate ancestors were soundly defeated.
Well, I'm talking with Michael Lind, and we're talking about the book Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. I'm Terrence McNally. This is Free Forum. One of the things that hadn't occurred to me that you point out is that the Southerners, the Southern oligarchs, actually kind of like the idea of being basically, if not titularly, a colony of Britain. And it was the Northeast that said, uh-uh.
Well, that was their whole plan. What destabilized the First American Republic was the fact that at the time of the Constitution was adopted, tobacco was still the largest Southern crop. You had enlightened Southern slave owners like Washington, who freed his slaves after his death, were trying to diversify the economy and make it based more on food for domestic consumption. The Industrial Revolution in Britain transformed America's economy even after the United States had seceded from Britain because for the first time in human history, you had international trade in a staple good for ordinary people that had always been produced locally before. That's clothing and other textiles. Before the textile revolution with steam-powered textile mills in Britain, which could just crank out textiles, wiping out all the textile industries in the rest of the world, the trade had been limited to largely drugs, you know, tobacco and sugar and spices, for, you know, for rich people. So you had the first industrial nation, and it needed this critical industrial raw material, which was cotton. And so and that was just a disaster for the South and for the United States because what could have evolved as a kind of Midwestern landscape of diversified economy in the South, there's no reason, you know, why the South had to have a single crop economy. It was because of the South's relation to the British Empire, even though the U.S. was formally independent from Britain. And the plan of the Confederates, having discouraged industrialization within the South, the only way their scheme could have succeeded was for Britain to intervene and go to war.
Right.
And that was and when Britain decided not to go to war on behalf of the Confederate states, that was the end of it.
Right.
In other words, because all the industry and the military power was in the northern industrial states.
So they conceived this partnership as being as essential to Britain as it was to them.
Yes, and it wasn't at all implausible because there was a lot of support in Britain. A lot of Britons did want Britain to intervene on behalf of the South. And what's more, if you look at the post-colonial colonies of Spain and Latin America, they actually were nominally sovereign resource colonies of Britain, of industrial Britain. They imported all of their manufactured goods from Britain. Their upper classes, you know, sent their sons to Eton. And so you could see a Confederate States of America evolving along the lines of Argentina, for example.
Now, here's a wacky question that I don't ask very often, but was Lincoln correct in choosing – and not just Lincoln, but was the North correct in choosing rather than just let the South go – if it wants to be a colony of Britain and live in the past and be a slave-owning agricultural colony, go right ahead. We're moving into the modern era.
Well, my liberal northern friends, I think in retrospect, they would have let the South go and conquered Canada, right? And we'd have universal health care and a much more social democratic system.
And in fact, I mean, I will take it and I assume this piece you probably won't disagree with, what that the resentments of the Civil War – fuel every election.
That's right. That's right. So, no, it's a legitimate question. So let's play this out. Lincoln, but particularly Seward, his Secretary of State, they were worried about the geopolitics of this. That is, if the South had turned to a military rival of the United States in order to secure its independence, what would prevent the South from being allied with enemies of the United States?
Well, I was suggesting even just letting them go. They secede and you go so long, but still they could.
That was still a concern because they controlled the mouth of the Mississippi.
They could absolutely, even if there hadn't been a war, they could still have allied themselves for the future.
And if you look at one of the precipitating factors for U.S. intervention in World War I, it was the Zimmerman telegram, where Germany offered Mexico, California, and Texas back if they went to war with the United States to tie down the U.S. so that it couldn't help
intervene in Europe
and so on. And I have no doubt that the Southern colonels who would have run this kind of broken down banana republic of the Confederacy, would have done so. Whether the enemy was some kind of German authoritarian state or now the really interesting thing is, what if you'd had something like communism? In the Soviet Union in the 20th century, I've often thought that the Confederate States, not Castro, might have tried to put in Soviet nuclear weapons along the Mason-Dixon line.
You've thought about this more than I have. But the point that I was getting at was the whole point of your book is that we need more of an industrial plan. A lot of the voice against that is the Old South.
Yeah, that's absolutely –
I mean, you wouldn't be writing this book for the reason that there wouldn't be the – that the North and – Canada, perhaps, would have been the most modern of modern countries.
Yeah, but I take a somewhat different angle. For one thing, I'm glad I grew up in the United States, not the broken down Republic of Texas, which would have seceded from the Confederacy and gone its own way. I think the real missed opportunity was not letting the South go, which would have been a tragedy for most of the black and white Southerners. It was the deal that was cut between the Southern elite and the Northern industrial elite after the Civil War.
Right.
Well, basically, the North got tired of enforcing civil rights. They got tired of fighting the Ku Klux Klan. So they withdrew the troops in 1877, the compromise and all that. And so essentially there was a deal from now – basically until the 1960s.
That's right.
The local oligarchy was given a free hand. You suppress labor. You do whatever you want. And in return, you don't try to secede anymore. And you will be an internal resource colony of the factories in the Northeast and the Midwest, which was a disaster. And one of the things I pointed out in my book on Lincoln, not in this book, is that Lincoln's allies actually wanted to develop the Scots-Irish regions of Appalachia. They wanted to put in railroads. They wanted to build big cities. They wanted to give people wage-earning jobs because, they understood the politics of it that haunt us to this day. If you detach the relatively poor white Southerners of the Highlands from the coastal oligarchy, then you've crippled the power of the Southern elite forever. But that's not the way history turned out, sadly.
Yeah. I will say, by the way, when I asked that question of Doris Kearns Goodwin, she said that she felt that Lincoln chose the way he did because the nation was so new so young, mm-hmm. not from the perspective we look now, but at right. that point, that to have admitted that you couldn't do what we'd attempted to do as an American enterprise, which was build a country based on ideals and blah, 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 that it, that you know that he felt he was upholding that as well as
– Well, that's the theme of the Gettysburg Address, and people don't understand it. He's not saying that if the South secedes, then democracy will be doomed in the remaining states of the Union. That's not what he's arguing. What he's arguing is that all of the enemies of democracy in other countries, in Europe and Latin America, will say, you know, Aristotle said you can't have large-scale democracies, you know, Montesquieu, and now the Americans proved it. Look, they had a national democracy. It fell down. So you can't have democracy bigger than the city-state or a small country.
Exactly.
That was one of his – and I think it was right.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me just throw you this question, which is moving more into where do we stand now, where are we going? I recall talking with Robert Reich at one point about the almost golden age of the post-World War II era, and you write about it as well, when there was a balance of forces between government, business, labor, and almost golden because of the problems with race and other issues that had yet to be dealt with. But does that fit your model, and what does that say about this moment we are right now?
Well, I argue that there was a period of Hamiltonian constructive nation building during the crisis of the Civil War and Reconstruction, also during the Great Depression and World War II, partly because you actually can overcome the paralysis built into our antiquated constitutional system if there are serious threats and the elites, which in peacetime would not take them seriously, think we have to take urgent action, even you know any means necessary, and I think that a combination of the threat of the Axis powers, of Stalin in the early Cold War, and also the memory of domestic demagogues like Huey P. Long, and the massive labor violence, you had a generation of leaders. There was an establishment in this country, which said there are some places we just can't go in terms of polarization and paralysis. And you can be a conservative Republican, liberal Democrat, but at the end of the day, we're all in this together, and there are limits to fratricide within the political class. And I think that several things happened. The United States lost this largely unearned prosperity, which came from the fact that all the other industrial countries of the world formed a circular firing squad between 1939 and 1945. So the Germans and the Japanese rebuilt, caught up by the 70s. And at that point, they were giving us – and some of the competition was legitimate because we were making shoddy goods, you know, compared to what they were doing.
Also, right around that same point, early 70s, is when the U.S. was no longer the number one producer of oil.
Yeah, exactly. So we lost that benefit. So at that point – the relations between business and labor, which as long as you know we're you can sharing the rents from exporting slapdash refrigerators, you know, to the ruined countries of Europe and Asia, so you get this divorce between labor and business, which there'd been an uneasy marriage, what happens then with the next wave of globalization? It gives corporations the power not simply to take plants out of the Northeast to the non-union South, to Texas or Mississippi or South Carolina, but to other countries altogether, right? Like China,
yeah.
You know, Foxconn in China. So the conditions for this kind of compact among government, labor, and business are deteriorating. But also, you know, the politics is not an independent variable here. You get, I think, with Newt Gingrich. Who's a very able individual in many ways, but he introduced this take no prisoners, annihilate the other side approach, which we just didn't have, partly because from the 1930s up until the 1970s when the Cold War starts winding down, there's this idea that we can't be seen ripping each other apart.
Well, also it's just the reinforcing power of a common enemy.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so I think if you look around now, what are the restraints? There's really no fear on the part of the elite. There are no riots in the streets. There's no, you know, mass marches.
I mean, it's so funny.
Occupy Wall Street, you know, fizzled out after a couple of months.
Well, I mean, I think it will be heard from again. But to look at what's happening in Montreal, right?
Right.
The student protests
fill
the streets, and you Montreal.
Yeah, and I think. I had expected there to be more of a shakeup following the crisis of the Great Recession, and in thinking why it hasn't happened,
That would have been my next question.
Yeah, well, part of it is the New Deal was too successful because unemployment insurance, which has saved many millions of Americans from misery, also meant that you don't have the visible evidence of the horrendous suffering that is going on.
So as weak as our safety net is to some European countries, it's still enough that it keeps the pin in the grenade.
Yeah, that's right. And if you look at professionals in the upper middle class and the well-to-do who suffered the least from this recession, they don't have to drive past lines of people lining up for soup kitchens. You know, they don't have to worry about the equivalent of hobos on the rails as happened in the 1930s. So in a way, I'm a supporter of these New Deal programs, but they have acted as a kind of anesthetic, I think. In the body politic, allowing people to believe that things really aren't as bad as they objectively are.
You say it has always taken a profound crisis. We both have said that we think this is a profound crisis, that this is not just another recession, that this is one of those moments of shakeup. A, what do you now think it's going to take to bring about that shakeup? And B, and this is something I know that you write about, is what would that shakeup produce? In other words, what do we need?
Well, let's not assume prematurely that the Great Recession is not going to turn out to be this epical event. We're less than 4 years away from the crash of 2000.
No, I'm in agreement with you there. That the effects are the persistence of the effects. If the depth of the effects was not so much that it caused
it,
but the persistence of it.
Yeah, in real estate, they have this term called capitulation. That's the point at which the homeowners who've been holding out for the price they want finally despair. And just give up all hope and sell for a loss. I think that the elites of the Western world, they're not there yet, but there will come the point of capitulation where they think, you know, it's not going to be another round of QE, of quantitative easing. Shale is not going to save us by creating this great economic renaissance. The system really has to be rebuilt from the ground up, and we're never going back. We're not quite there yet. But a lot of people, and I include myself in this group, we sort of mistakenly saw 2008 with Obama's election as being like 1932. What if it was more like 1929?
You say he's more a Hoover than a Roosevelt.
Well, just in the terms of the situation.
Yeah.
From 1929 all the way until 1931, and Hoover did some good things to ameliorate the worst excesses of the Depression, including creating the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which is sort of like the TARP, bailing out the banks, and then FDR. A lot of the New Deal things were actually Hoover institutions that were expanded greatly under Roosevelt, his successor. But all the way up until 1931, there was this idea that we're almost out of the woods, almost out of the woods. And Hoover is somewhat unfairly ridiculed nowadays for having these completely out-of-touch remarks. But that's what most of the elite believe, right? I think we're kind of in this Hoover world. Finally, when Credit Anstalt fails in Austria, Germany collapses. Ironically, it's Germany. It's what is now the Eurozone. When that goes down, at that point, you get a plunge deeper into the Depression worldwide. And at that point, the ground is cleared for more radical action.
Because, now, we don't want that to happen, but that could be replayed again.
Yeah, but so if you think that this is about over and that we're in this recovery and it's a weak recovery, you know, then that scenario is not relevant. If you think that this is a permanent historic crisis which will go on for 10 or 25 years worldwide, then the order that emerges in North America, in Europe, and Asia is going to be as different from the one that we're familiar with as the one in the 1950s was from the one in the 1920s. It won't emerge because anyone has a particular master plan.
Mm.
A lot of it will emerge under the pressure of events. But let me just say, you don't know how politicians will respond to these events, right? So if Obama is reelected or if Romney becomes president, you may have much more radical action in the next 4 years in response to the pressure of events than you've had in the 4 years just because of this sense.
You're saying notwithstanding what they say today or what their people who vote for them even think is going to happen, saying events may force whoever's elected to take more radical action.
That's right. At the beginning of the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln wanted to offer the South a guarantee of slavery until the 1900s. right, as long as they came back. There was no plan for an Emancipation Proclamation or Reconstruction. Franklin Roosevelt, 1932, argued that Hoover was spending too much money.
Yeah.
He ran to
Hoover's
right.
They both were elected as moderates in a time of crisis.
Yeah, and in fact, they had been friends earlier. They had worked together in the Wilson administration. I was reading a biography of FDR. I didn't know this, that no one was sure whether Hoover, who was kind of a great hero for his role in saving the Belgians from starvation during World War I, whether he was a Democrat or Republican. So in 1920, some of the Democrats wanted Hoover to run for president and Franklin Roosevelt as vice president.
Yeah. No, I mean, Hoover's status prior to his fall from grace was he was one of the great heroes in America.
Yeah. And
earned.
And Hoover seriously damaged his posthumous reputation because he became bitterly reactionary after he was defeated by FDR. And even his friends would have to point out, well, you're criticizing Roosevelt for some of these programs like the RFC, the Reconstruction Finance Corps, which you enacted.
Right. It's like Romney Care, Obamacare.
Yeah. But so I do criticize Hoover. He's the one really who gave plausibility to these claims that liberalism is socialistic or fascist or communistic. He spent the rest of the 30s very bitter denouncing the Democrats as the collectivist party. Now, interestingly enough, Truman, who did not have great relations with Franklin Roosevelt when he was vice president, brought Hoover in and sent him as a special envoy to Germany and put him on a – so he was kind of rehabilitated later in life.
Let me ask this. Why one of the things you argue for – throughout history, but to bring it up to the present, is industrial policy. Where you come out on for big government
right.
is that we, in times of technological change, to make up for what we've lost in these lag times, is industrial policy. Why are the big money players opposed to federal government industrial policy, which it seems helps nations like China and Germany? Or is it that their political money dominated brand of government provides just the amount and type of industrial policy that serves their needs?
Well, there's a mixture of self-interest and authentic ideology involved. That is, the economics profession, neoclassical economists, even the Democrats tend to say industrial policy will always fail. Larry Summers recently said the government is a lousy venture capitalist. Well, Summers is right. I mean, if you look at it, if you exclude from the list of federal venture capital, the Transcontinental Railroad, radio, television,
interstate highways,
industry,
internet,
the internet, the computer, nuclear energy. If you factor all of that out and look only at Solyndra and its Synfuels, you know, in the Carter administration, then yes, it's a failure, right? But just objectively, it seems to me it's hard to make that case. But nevertheless, it's kind of hard to argue with all of the Ivy League economists, right, Democrats as well as Republicans. So there's this kind of sincere belief repeated in editorial boards that industrial policy always fails.
What about when they look at Germany and China?
Well, I have this debate with people in Washington and in New York all the time, and they have managed to persuade themselves – this is ideology triumphing over fact – that for example, there's one scholar I won't name, but he's a prominent American Japan expert, that Japan has done everything in spite of Japan's government policy. It was all private entrepreneurs. Now, of course, no Japanese believes this.
Right.
Right. The German industrial policy is just as real. It's less tangible. It's less overt. But it's based on government business union collaboration on behalf of the nation. And in China, it's overt, where most of the economy is state-owned enterprises. And the Chinese state-controlled banking system just funnels money to unprofitable enterprises according to a plan. It has nothing to
right.
do with thereby wiping out a lot of ours. So, you know, my own view of industrial policy is we have it. We have always had it. We are going to have it. The question is whether our industrial policy is made by us through our elected representatives or whether it's made by Beijing, Tokyo, or Berlin.
And while it might be bastardized, if you will, it seems to me that our industrial policy has for the last 20 years or so been finance, finance, finance.
It's been finance. And if you include real estate in there, that even strengthens it. It's what's called the FIRE sector, finance, insurance, real estate.
Yeah.
And so we have had a massive government industrial policy promoting the financial asset industry, including real estate, just pouring fuel on the bubble. If we had put all of that energy and and genius into developing new manufacturing industries, we'd be in a different place today.
Yeah. I mean, and one thing, when I look at Germany versus the U.S., the Americans made a decision to peers, and my guess is it's Wall Street and Wall Street financed D.C. that did so, was we will China will be our workers.
Right.
We will not compete with China. We will sell to China. Germany said we will create things China can't create. Yeah, we will not compete with China. We will compete. You know.
That's exactly right. Germany has an economy that's complementary to China's in many ways.
Exactly.
Providing them with machine tools, with high value added ingredients. There was a report by the Asian Development Bank about when it went into the iPhone. The majority of the high value added ingredients of the iPhone come from Germany, Japan, and South Korea. You have cheap labor in China putting it together. Now, down the road, the Chinese are going to move up the scale, and this German-Japanese strategy may not work anymore. But the public has not been told this. You know, the public has been told that Japan went away and that there's no longer this problem of German competition. What our industrial rivals figured out they could do is they could cycle their exports to us indirectly by rocketing through South China and then into Walmart. But a lot of the stuff that you're buying that says made in China, parts of it are made in Japan and Germany. Mm-hmm. Germany, amazingly, is the world's second exporter in terms of overall exports.
And depending on how currency goes, sometimes it's first.
Yeah, and it's only got 80 million people compared
right.
to China, you know, with more than a billion people. Now, I don't think this is sustainable in the long run, which
for
is
Germany.
Why – for the world economy.
Ah.
This is why I'm pessimistic, why I think that there's going to be a second crash coming. And the reason is if you look at 2008 before the crash, the United States economy was equal more or less – to Germany, Japan, and China, the other three industrial economies combined. All of those other industrial economies, three out of the four, were running perpetual high value-added manufacturing surpluses. The only way they could do that was for the United States, Greece, other countries to borrow money from them to run perpetual
consumption.
Trade deficits.
Consumption.
Exactly.
Cultures, yeah.
Once those consumers are tapped out in the U.S. and Greece, that means this huge overbuilt industrial sector of the other three largest industrial countries, now China, Japan, and Germany in that order, they're out of clients. They're out of customers.
Yeah.
Now, what has tended to happen in history at that point is not what economists, Keynesian economists anyway, recommend and that I support, which is that they raise the wages of their workers so that they can consume the products they buy. That's the ideal system. That would be the ideal rebalancing from this unbalanced system. What happened after the long depression of the 1870s and then in the 1930s was they tend to countries protect their overbuilt industrial sectors through protectionism and through current rival currency devaluation and so on. And that means a kind of zero-sum trade war world because every country cannot run a perpetual trade surplus. And the patsies – and Martin Wolf, the Financial Times columnist, you know, he uses this term for countries like the U.S. that supported these mercantilist – that's the technical term for export-oriented strategies. When they get tired of playing the patsies to the mercantilists, if everybody tries to be a mercantilist, at that point the world economy divides. It falls apart along regional blocks. Because – and you get a world of protectionism and of rival trade wars. And I think that at this point seems more likely all the time, particularly – there was a brief moment of hope right after the crisis of 2008 because the U.S. quite correctly managed to persuade the other industrial countries to engage in stimulus.
Right.
Which is what you should do right. in a depression. But now the Germans have decided – you know, they're going to – they will risk European and global deflation rather than, you know, adopt Keynesian stimulus measures. The Chinese essentially use that stimulus money to build up their overbuilt export sector even more instead of putting money into the pockets of their rural farmers.
Right.
In the long run, I think when the smoke clears, you will have a rebalanced world economy. In fact, the United States in the 1920s and 30s was very like China today. You had very rich, developed industrial regions. You had very, very poor rural hinterlands. You needed to shift from this tariff-based model of development comparable to modern Chinese state capitalism, you know, to a more liberalized trading order. What happened was We actually achieved that by the 50s and 60s, but it took a depression in World War II.
Okay. So in the intro, I said that what was hopeful was that we'd reinvented ourselves before and we could do it again. We weren't able to end this hour's conversation on much of a hopeful note, but both of us believe that the worst precedes the best and the worst has yet to come.
I'm a long-run optimist.
Right.
I'm not necessarily a short-run.
Again, the book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. To learn more, go to newamerica.net and look for Michael Lind. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have that delivered to you weekly. You can do both of those things at iTunes or at my site, terrencemcnally.net. Or aworldthatjustmightwork.com to the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests and issues, sign up at my site, or you can email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also check out Free Forum with Terrence McNally on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. I look forward to being with you again next week. And finally, thank you to Michael Lind, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.